Thus, if we seek to penetrate the mysteries of human nature through our own efforts, we must abide by the golden rule of the occult sciences. This rule states, for every single step that you take in seeking knowledge of hidden truths, you must take 3 steps in perfecting your character toward the good. Whoever follows this rule can do the following exercises. We visualize a person whom we have observed longing for something, and we direct our attention to this desire. It is best to recall the moment when the desire was strongest, and we did not yet know whether the person would obtain the object of their desire. Then we surrender ourselves to this picture, completely dedicated to what we can observe in our memory. We create the greatest imaginable inner calm in our souls. We try as far as possible to be deaf and blind to everything else going on around us. Above all, we pay close attention to any feeling that the mental image we have formed awakens in our souls. Then we allow this feeling to rise up within us like a cloud on an otherwise empty horizon. Naturally, this exercise often breaks down. We find that we are usually unable to observe the person who is the object of our attention in the state of desire for a sufficient length of time. The lack of first-hand observation interferes with our contemplation and cuts it short. Thus, we may have to make hundreds upon hundreds of unsuccessful attempts. Above all, we must not lose patience. Eventually, after many attempts, we shall experience in ourselves a feeling corresponding to the inner soul state of the individual we are contemplating. Then, before long, we begin to notice that this feeling produces a force in the soul. This force then becomes the spiritual perception of the other person's soul state. An image, experienced as shining, enters our field of vision. This spiritual, shining picture is the so-called astral embodiment of the state of soul we observed, that is, of the desire. As before, we perceive this as flame-like. Its center gives an impression of the color yellow-red, and its periphery affects us as the color red-blue or purple would. It is important that we handle these spiritual perceptions gently. It is best to begin with not to talk about them, except perhaps with our teacher if we have one. If we try to describe such a phenomenon in inappropriate language, it usually leads to gross delusions. Ordinary words were not made for such things and are too coarse and clumsy to do them justice. The result is that when we attempt to describe our experience in such words, we are misled into mixing all kinds of fantastic illusions with real spiritual visions. Here, then, is another important rule for the student of occult knowledge. Know how to be silent about your spiritual perceptions. Yes, even be silent about them with yourself. Do not try to clothe in words what you see in the spirit, nor try to understand it with your ordinary, unskilled reason. Give yourself fully to your spiritual perception and do not disturb it with too much pondering. Remember that your thinking is not yet on the level of your spiritual vision. You have acquired this thinking in a life that until now has been limited wholly to the physical world. But what you are now acquiring goes beyond that. Therefore, do not seek to measure these new, higher perceptions by the same standard that you measured your old ones. Once we can observe our inner experiences steadily, then we can speak about them and thereby inspire our fellow human beings to activity. The above exercise may be supplemented by the following complementary one. This time, we contemplate a person whose desire or longing has been fulfilled. Following the same rules and precautions as before, we attain another, different spiritual perception. We again see a spiritual flame form. But now this feels yellow in the center and light green at the periphery. Observing and contemplating our fellow human beings in this way, we can easily fall into a moral error. We can lose our love for them. We must do everything imaginable to ensure that this does not happen. In fact, we should undertake these exercises only when we have developed the absolute certainty that thoughts are realities. then we shall not allow ourselves to think of our fellow human beings in any way that is incompatible with the profound respect due their dignity and freedom. The idea that another person could be merely an object of observation must never, even for a moment, take hold of us. Every esoteric observation of human nature must be accompanied by self-education in the ability to appreciate unreservedly the full individual value of every person. All that dwells within each human being, including thoughts and feelings, must be considered holy and inviolable. We must be filled with a profound awe for everything human, even in our memories and recollections. These preliminary exercises give two examples of how we may gain insight into human nature. If nothing else, they show the path that we must follow. Indeed, we need only discover the necessary inner quiet and calm belonging to such meditations for our souls to undergo a great transformation. The inner enrichment that we experience in our being soon makes even our outer conduct more confident and serene, and this transformed behavior then reacts positively upon our souls. Thereby, we help ourselves along in our development. We will always find ways and means of discovering more and more of human nature that is hidden from our outer senses. As we do so, we gradually progress to the point of glimpsing the mysterious kinship between human nature and all else that exists in the universe. In this way, we shall be drawing closer to the moment when we can take the first steps in the stage of initiation. But before we can take these first steps, one thing more is necessary. Though to begin with we cannot see why this is so, later, however, we shall understand it. Candidates for initiation must bring with them two additional qualities, courage and fearlessness. These have a certain relationship with each other and must be developed together. As esoteric students, we must deliberately seek out situations in which these virtues may be cultivated. Indeed, in occult training, they are developed quite systematically. From this point of view, life itself is also a good occult school, perhaps the best. We must be able to look danger calmly in the eye and overcome difficulties without hesitation. When facing a danger, we should immediately be stirred to the conviction, all fear is useless. I must not let it take hold of me. I must think only of what is to be done. In fact, we must reach a point in situations that earlier would have caused us to be afraid, in which the very idea of fear and lack of courage become things impossible for us to conceive in the core of our soul. Such self-education in courage and fearlessness develops quite specific forces that we need for initiation into higher knowledge. Just as we need healthy nerves as physical beings to make use of our physical senses, so, as beings of soul, we need the strength that develops only in courageous and fearless natures. For as we penetrate the higher mysteries, we see things that were previously hidden from us by the illusions of the senses. In fact, it is a blessing that our physical senses do not allow us to perceive the higher truths. In this way, they protect us from things that, if we saw them unprepared, would cause us great dismay, things we could not bear to see. As students of the occult, we must train ourselves to bear these sights. In the process, we shall inevitably lose some of the supports that the external world provided for us as long as we were caught up in its illusions. What happens is literally the same as when people are made aware of a danger that was present for a long time but which they knew nothing of. Unaware of the danger, they were, of course, also unafraid. But once they know about it, they are overcome with fear, even though the danger has not increased by their knowing about it. The world's powers are both destructive and constructive. The fate of sense-perceptible beings is to arise and pass away. The initiate must see and understand how these forces and this fate work themselves out. For this, the veil that lies before our spiritual eyes in ordinary life must be removed. Of course, we ourselves are closely interwoven with these forces and with fate. Our individual natures, like the world, contain destructive and constructive forces. As initiates, our own souls will be revealed before our seeing eyes as nakedly as all other things. Students must not lose strength in the face of such self-knowledge. They must come to meet it with a surplus of forces. In order to have this surplus, we must learn to maintain our inward calm and certainty in difficult life situations and cultivate an unshakable trust in the good powers of existence. We should be prepared for the fact that many motives that have previously guided us can no longer do so. We shall have to realize that we thought and did many things simply because we were caught up in ignorance. The grounds we had for doing things no longer hold good. We may often have acted out of conceit, but we now come to realize how unspeakably useless all vanity is to the initiate. We have been motivated by greed, and now we realize how destructive greed is. We have to develop completely new grounds for acting and thinking, and this is what involves courage and fearlessness. Above all, we need to cultivate courage and fearlessness in the inmost depths of our thought life itself. We must learn not to be discouraged by failure. We should be able to think, "I will forget that I failed again, and I will try once more as if it never happened." In this way, we struggle to the conviction that the sources of strength in the world that we can draw from are inexhaustible. Again and again, we aspire to the Spirit, which will lift us up and carry us, regardless of how often our earthly being proves to be weak and powerless. We must become capable of living into the future and not let any past experiences disturb our striving. Once we have developed the above-described qualities to a certain extent, we are ready to learn the true names of things. These names are the keys to higher knowledge. Initiation is learning to call the things of the world by the names they have in the minds of their divine authors. These names contain the secrets of things. Initiates speak a different language from the uninitiated because, as initiates, they call things by the names through which they were created. To the extent that initiation can be talked about at all, it will be discussed in the next chapter. Chapter 3, Initiation. Initiation is the highest level of esoteric training about which generally intelligible written indications may still be given. Whatever lies beyond initiation is difficult to communicate in an understandable way. Yet the path to this knowledge is open to all who have worked their way through the stages of preparation, illumination, and initiation, and reached the lower mysteries. Initiation bestows upon us knowledge and abilities we would otherwise acquire in a different way and form only in the distant future after many incarnations. A person initiated today experiences in this life something that he or she would normally experience only later and under quite different circumstances. We can fully experience only as much of the mysteries of existence as the level of our maturity allows. This is the only reason why we find obstacles on our path to higher knowledge and capacities. One should not use a firearm until one has had enough experience to use it without causing damage. If we were initiated today without preparation, we would lack the experiences we would otherwise continue to gather through future incarnations up to the moment when, as part of the normal course of our development, these mysteries were revealed to us. As we arrive at the doorway to initiation, these experiences must be replaced by something else. Therefore, the first instructions given to candidates for initiation form a substitute for future experiences they would have had in lives to come. These instructions concern the so-called trials through which a candidate must pass. The trials themselves arise as the natural consequence of our soul life when the exercises described in the previous chapters have been practiced in the right way. Such trials, of course, are often mentioned in books, but by their very nature, such descriptions generally give a false impression. For a person who has not passed through the stages of preparation and illumination has never experienced these trials and therefore cannot correctly describe them. Certain things and facts belonging to the higher worlds necessarily arise for candidates for initiation. But we shall only see and hear these if we are sensitive to the spiritual perceptions of shapes, colors, sounds, and so forth described in the chapters on preparation and illumination. The first trial consists in achieving a truer perception than the average person possesses of the physical properties, initially of inanimate bodies and then of plants, animals, and human beings. This has nothing to do with what is called scientific knowledge. We are not concerned here with science, but with perception. As a rule, the procedure is one in which, as candidates for initiation, we learn to recognize how natural things and living beings reveal themselves to our spiritual ears and eyes. In a certain sense, these things stand before us unveiled or naked. The qualities that we come to see and hear were veiled from our physical sight and hearing. The fact that during initiation this veil falls away is due to a process called the process of spiritual burning away. For this reason, the first trial is called the fire trial. For many people, ordinary life is already a more or less unconscious process of initiation through the fire trial. Such people have lived a life so rich in experiences that their self-confidence, courage, and steadfastness have matured in healthy ways. They have learned to bear suffering, disappointment, and failure calmly, magnanimously, and with unbroken strength. People who have worked through their experiences in this way are often already, although without knowing it clearly, initiates. It then takes only a little to open their spiritual eyes and ears so that they become seers. One thing is certain, the purpose of the real fire trial is not to satisfy our curiosity. To be sure, we shall come to know extraordinary facts that other people have no inkling of. But acquaintance with such facts is not the objective. It is but the means to an end. The objective is to acquire truer self-confidence, greater courage, and quite a different kind of magnanimity and endurance than is normally attainable within the lower world. Candidates may still turn back after the fire trial. They may return to ordinary life, strengthened in body and soul, and continue their initiation in a future incarnation. If we decide to do this, we become more useful members of society and humanity in our present incarnation than we were before. Whatever our situation may be, our inner strength, mindfulness, and positive effect on other people will have increased. If, having completed the fire trial, we decide to continue the path of initiation, then a particular system of writing, customarily used in occult training, is unveiled to us. The characters of this script reveal the actual secret teachings. For what is really hidden in things is not directly expressible in the words of ordinary language, nor recordable in any ordinary system of writing. Rather, those who have learned from initiates translate the teachings of esoteric science into ordinary language as best they can. This occult script is inscribed forever in the spiritual world. Once the soul has attained spiritual perception, the script is revealed to it. But we do not learn to read this occult alphabet in the same way that we learn to read an ordinary human alphabet. Rather, it is as if we grow toward clairvoyant knowing. And while we grow, there develops in us, as a soul faculty, a force impelling us to decipher, as if they were the characters of a script, the events and beings of the spiritual world present before us. As our inner development unfolds, it can happen that this power and the experience of the trial connected with it appear on their own. However, we shall be more likely to reach our goal if we follow the instructions of experienced esoteric researchers who are proficient in deciphering the hidden script. The signs of this occult writing are not arbitrarily devised, but correspond to the forces at work in the world. Through these signs, we learn the language of things. As candidates for initiation, we realize immediately that these signs correspond to the figures, colors, and sounds that we learn to perceive in the earlier stages of preparation and illumination. It becomes apparent that all that came before was like learning the letters of an alphabet in order to spell. But now we begin to read in the higher world. All that previously appeared only in isolated figures, sounds, and colors now appears as one great connected and interrelated whole. For the first time, we experience complete certainty in our observation of the higher worlds. Before, we could never be sure whether the things we saw were seen correctly. At this point, for the first time, regular communication is possible between candidates and initiates concerning the realms of higher knowledge. For however closely an initiate may live together with other people in everyday life, he or she can communicate higher knowledge directly only in the sign language mentioned above. Through this language, we are introduced to certain rules for the conduct of life. We learn of duties we knew nothing about before. Knowing these rules of conduct, we become able to perform actions with a significance that the actions of uninitiated people could never have. We act out of the higher worlds. The directives for such actions can be received only in the occult script. It should be emphasized that there are people who perform such actions unconsciously, without having undergone an esoteric training. These helpers of the world and humanity pass through life bestowing blessings and good deeds wherever they go. For reasons that will not be discussed here, they have been endowed with gifts that seem supernatural. They differ from those following the path to higher knowledge only in that the latter act consciously, understanding the larger context of their actions. What we, as occult students, achieve through training and esoteric practice, the higher powers bestow on these blessed people for the benefit of the whole world. We should revere those so favored by God, but we should not therefore consider the work of esoteric training superfluous. After we have learned to read the occult sign writing, another trial begins. In this trial, we must demonstrate that we can move freely and surely in the higher worlds. In ordinary life, impulses from the external world prompt our actions. We work at this or that job because our situation imposes certain duties upon us. Needless to say, we must not neglect any of our duties because we are living in the higher worlds. No higher duty should force us to neglect even one of our duties in the ordinary world. If we are parents, we shall continue to fulfill our responsibilities just as well as we did before entering upon the path to higher knowledge. Whatever our job may be, whether government official or soldier, following the path to higher knowledge should not keep us from doing our job. On the contrary, esoteric training enhances, to a degree inconceivable to the uninitiated, the very qualities that make us competent in life. If this does not always seem to be the case, it is because those who have not been initiated do not know how to judge those who have been. The actions of the initiated are not always readily comprehensible to others. But, as has been said, this applies in just a few cases. We have now reached a level of initiation where we have duties to perform, but no outward reason to do so. We are moved to carry them out not by external circumstances, but only by the standards revealed to us in the hidden language of the secret script. In this second trial, we must demonstrate that we can act according to these standards as surely and steadily as good secretaries carry out the duties that devolve upon them. To this end, we shall feel ourselves faced, in the course of our training, with a particular task. We must act on the basis of perceptions made as a result of what we learned during preparation and illumination. We must discover what we are to do by reading the occult writing that we have now made our own. If we can recognize our duty and carry it out correctly, then we have successfully passed this trial. We can tell whether we have succeeded in carrying out a duty from the changes in the figures, colors, and sounds we perceive with our spiritual ears and eyes. The instructions for esoteric training describe exactly what these figures and so on are supposed to look like after our action, and how we are to perceive them. As candidates for initiation, We must learn how to produce such changes in our spiritual perceptions. This trial is called the water trial, because when we act in these higher realms, outer circumstances no longer support us, just as we lose the ground under our feet when we swim in deep water. This practice should be repeated until we have complete confidence in our abilities. As in the fire trial, the water trial has to do with acquiring a certain quality or virtue that would normally take many incarnations to develop. But as a result of our experiences in the higher world, we are able to develop this quality in a short time and to an advanced degree. The point is this. In order to produce these changes in the higher realms, we must learn to act wholly according to our spiritual perceptions and our reading of the secret script. If we let any personal wishes, opinions, and so forth enter this activity, if we fail even for a moment to comply with the laws we know are right and follow instead our own whims, then something quite different will happen than was intended. Our activity would immediately lose its bearing, its objective, and confusion would intrude. This trial provides us with abundant opportunities for the development of self-control, which is of prime importance. The trial will thus be easier for those who have acquired self-control in their lives before initiation. Those who can follow high principles and ideals regardless of personal feelings and desires, who understand the need to perform duties even when inclinations and sympathies turn them in another direction, are already, and without knowing it, initiates in ordinary life. For such people, passing this second trial will be an easy matter. Indeed, it must be said that as a rule, one must already have achieved a certain, albeit unconscious, degree of initiation to pass this trial. For just as it is difficult to learn to write as an adult when one has not learned to do so as a child, so it is difficult to develop the self-control necessary at the moment of insight into higher worlds if one has not already achieved a certain amount of self-control in everyday life. Our wishes, desires, and inclinations do not change the realities of the physical world, but they have a real effect on the things of the higher worlds. To produce a particular effect in the higher worlds, therefore, we must have complete power over ourselves. We must be able to follow the right discipline and not be subject to our own arbitrariness. An important human quality that enters into consideration above all else at this stage of initiation is an unconditionally sound, reliable power of judgment. This faculty needs to be trained through all the earlier stages. Whether this has been done or not shows whether we are fit for the true path of knowledge. For to continue on this path, we must now be able to distinguish true reality from illusion, insubstantial figments of the imagination, superstition, and all manner of delusion. Making this distinction is, to begin with, more difficult on these higher planes of existence than on the lower ones. All preconceptions and cherished beliefs must disappear. Truth alone must be the guiding principle. We have to be perfectly prepared to let go of any thought, opinion, or inclination if logical thinking demands it. Certainty in the higher worlds cannot be attained if one is in any way attached to one's own opinions. Progress on the esoteric path is impossible if our way of thinking tends toward fantasy and superstition. We are on the verge of gaining a precious gift. We are about to lose all doubts concerning the higher worlds. They are to be revealed before our spiritual eyes in all their lawfulness. But we cannot receive this treasure as long as we allow ourselves to be deceived by illusion and delusion. It would be fatal if we allowed fantasy and prejudices to run away with our reason. Indeed, dreamers and fantasists are as little fitted for the occult path as are those who are superstitious. The worst enemies on the path of higher cognition are dreaming, fantasizing, and superstition. These enemies cannot be taken too seriously. Nevertheless, we must always remember that although all prejudices must fall from you is inscribed over the door leading to the second trial, and without healthy human understanding all steps are in vain stands at the entrance to the first, This by no means implies that esoteric students lose the poetry of life and the capacity for enthusiasm. Once we have matured sufficiently along these lines, a third trial awaits us. This trial is without any tangible, distinct goal. Everything is up to us. We find ourselves in a situation where nothing moves us to act. We must each find our own way, by ourselves and out of ourselves. There are no things or people who might help us to act. Nothing and nobody can give us the strength we need, except we ourselves. If we do not find this strength within ourselves, we will soon be back where we were before. It must be said, however, that such failures are rare. Having passed the previous trials, we are likely to find the strength. A person who has not turned back before will generally succeed this time too. Here, what matters is the ability to collect oneself promptly and act decisively. For now, in the true sense of the word, we must discover the higher self. We must resolve at every moment to listen to the inspiration of the Spirit in all things. There is no longer time for scruples, doubts, and so on. Each moment of hesitation only proves that we are not yet ready. We must courageously overcome all that keeps us from listening to the Spirit. What matters is that we show presence of mind under these circumstances. This is the quality or attribute to be cultivated during this stage of development. For this purpose, all our habitual enticements to act and even to think now disappear. To avoid falling into passivity, therefore, our task is not to lose ourselves. Only within ourselves will we find a fixed point to hold onto. No one who reads these lines without knowing anything about what they refer to should feel any antipathy for this condition of being thrown back upon oneself. On the contrary, to pass this trial means the highest bliss. Everyday life can serve as an esoteric school for the spiritual presence of mind, just as it does for the other qualities required for initiation. This is particularly true in the case of those who, suddenly confronted with life's tasks or problems, have learned to act rapidly and decisively, without hesitation or reflection. We learn this ability above all in situations whose successful outcome depends upon speedy action. For example, if we could act quickly when a misfortune threatens, one that could not be averted if we hesitated even for a moment, and if we could make such decisiveness a permanent quality, we have already unconsciously prepared ourselves for the third trial. This trial is intended to develop absolute presence of mind. In schools for esoteric training, this trial is called the air trial. Here we can rely neither on the solid ground of outer motivation, nor on insights gained from the shapes, colors, and so on we came to know in the stages of preparation and illumination. Instead, we must now rely completely upon ourselves. Once we have passed this trial, we may enter the temple of higher cognition. Of this, little more remains to be said. Only the barest indications may be given. The task to be accomplished now is often described as having to swear an oath never to betray the secret teachings. However, the term oath and betray are inaccurate and even misleading. There is no question here of an oath in an ordinary sense of the word. Rather, it is a matter of experience. We learn how to apply the secret teachings, how to place them at the service of humanity. Only now do we begin to understand the world properly. What is important is not to conceal and withhold the higher truths, but to learn to present them tactfully, appropriately, and in the right way. What we learn to keep silent about is something quite different. We now acquire the noble quality of silence with regard to many things we used to talk about before, and especially with regard to how we used to talk about them. We would be poor initiates if we did not place the mysteries we have experienced at the service of the world as much as possible. The only obstacle to communication in this area is the failure of others to understand what we say. Naturally, the higher mysteries are not suited to aimless talk and chatter. But this is not to forbid a person who has reached this stage of development to speak. No one, Neither a human nor any other kind of being will ever impose such an oath upon us. We alone are responsible. We must learn to discover within ourselves what is to be done in every situation. The oath means nothing more than that we are ready to bear such responsibility. When we are sufficiently matured for these experiences, we receive what is called symbolically the potion of oblivion. That is, we are initiated into the secret of action, uninterrupted by the lower memory. This is necessary for an initiate who must always have complete confidence in the immediate present. We must know how to tear down the veils of memory that surround us at every moment of our lives. Otherwise, if I judge today's experiences by those of yesterday, I become subject to many errors. This does not mean that we should deny our prior experiences. On the contrary, as far as possible, they should always be present. But initiates have to be able to judge each new experience on its own merits and let it work upon them untroubled by the past. In other words, I must always be ready to receive a new revelation from each and every being and thing. To judge the new on the basis of the old only leads to errors. Yet the memory of past experiences is useful precisely because it enables one to see new ones. That is, without a given past experience, I might never see the characteristic feature of the things or beings I encounter. Past experiences should help us to see what is new, not to judge it. As initiates, we develop quite specific faculties for this. Thereby, many things reveal themselves that remain hidden from the uninitiated. The second potion given to initiates is the potion of memory. This enables one to keep the higher mysteries always present and in mind. Our ordinary memory is insufficient for this. We must become completely one with the higher mysteries. Merely knowing them is not enough. They must become as much a matter of course to us in our daily actions as eating and drinking are to ordinary people. They must become practice, habit, disposition, so that we do not need to think about them in the ordinary sense. They should express themselves through us, flow through us like the vital functions of our organism. In this way, we grow spiritually closer to the level that nature has already brought us to physically. Chapter 4. Practical Considerations. Educating our feelings, thoughts, and moods in the ways indicated in the sections on preparation, illumination, and initiation fashions an organization in our soul and our spirit similar to the one produced by nature in the physical body. Without such a training, our soul and spirit remain unstructured masses. In this state, clairvoyant seers perceive them as intertwined, spiraling, cloud-like vortices. These have a dull glow and are generally sensed as reddish and red-brown or red-yellow in color. After esoteric training, however, the vortices display an orderly structure and are seen as shining spiritually in yellow-green or green-blue colors. We achieve such a regular structure of soul and spirit, and thereby higher knowledge, too, when we order our feelings, thoughts, and moods, just as nature orders our bodily functions, enabling us to see, hear, digest, breathe, speak, and so forth. The order we create in this way gradually enables us to breathe and see with the soul, and to hear, speak, and so on with the spirit. The present chapter will examine in greater detail some practical approaches to esoteric development that are part of the higher education of soul and spirit. These practices are such that basically any of us can adopt them, regardless of any other rules we are following. Indeed, anyone who follows these additional suggestions will advance quite far in esoteric science. We must strive especially to train our capacities for patience. Every stirring of impatience paralyzes, even destroys, the higher faculties latent within us. We should not desire or expect to achieve boundless insights into higher worlds overnight. for then, as a rule, they will certainly not come to us. Instead, contentment with even our smallest achievement, along with calm and detachment, should increasingly fill our souls. Certainly, as students, we are understandably impatient to see the results of our efforts. Yet we can achieve nothing until we can master our impatience. On the other hand, merely to fight against impatience in the ordinary way does no good. It only strengthens it. We would only be deceiving ourselves, and our impatience would sink its roots deeper into our souls. Only if we surrender ourselves repeatedly to a particular thought, making it completely our own, can we achieve anything. This thought is, I must do everything I can for the education of my soul and spirit, but I will wait calmly until the higher powers consider me worthy of illumination. Once this thought has become so powerful in us that it has become part of our character, then we are on the right path. Before long, this new character trait puts its outward signature upon us. Our gaze becomes calm, our eyes steady, our movements confident, our decisions definite. Any nervousness we previously felt gradually disappears. At this point, certain apparently insignificant little rules must be observed. For example, let us say someone offends us. Previously, before esoteric training, we would have turned our feelings against the offender. Irritation and anger would have bubbled up within us. Now that we are on the path to higher knowledge, however, the thought immediately comes to us. This insult does not alter my true worth. Then we do what needs to be done, calmly and with detachment rather than out of anger. This does not mean that we simply swallow insults. Rather, we should be as calm and confident in responding to insults directed at us as we would be if we acted on behalf of someone else who had been insulted. We must always bear in mind that esoteric learning does not occur through great outer events, but rather through quiet, subtle, inner changes in our lives of thought and feeling. Patience has the effect of attracting the treasures of higher knowledge. Impatience repels them. Haste and unrest achieve nothing in the higher realms of existence. Above all, longing and craving must be silenced. These are soul qualities in the face of which all higher knowledge shyly retreats.